Before I changed to number 6, I used to be 24 because I wanted to be one better than Michael Jordan. I know.
How'd that work out?
Not very well.
Also, don't tell him that because he'll crush you.
I know he will. And he'll like yell at me and he'll be like, man, I really just want to beat up on little 10-year-old Sarah, a little volleyball player, wanted to be one better than Michael Jordan.
This is Dig and Swing, a volleyball podcast for everyday coaches.
So like if Michael Jordan screamed at you, I think the whole time you'd be sitting there, you'd be like, oh my God, Michael's acknowledging my presence.
He knows I'm like, I exist.
Yeah, he's mad at me. Ah, it's whatever. I don't care that he's mad at me.
So dream team. When they put that dream team together in 92, they're at the Olympics and their opponents are asking for their autographs.
Yeah, that's a tough look. That's a real tough look.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about competitive cauldrons today.
Hey, what did you do?
I don't have a thing. Like I usually have like a list of questions and stuff, but I don't actually have that this time, whether it's out of laziness or it's just laziness this time. But I want to talk about them because BJ and I were talking about it that one day, and I have tried to implement it and was not... I just struggled with it. It was just really hard to keep up with. So I think that, first of all, who do I have on here today? I have a full house today. This is the maximum amount of people we can have in this. So I have Brian Swingle, the other half of Dig and Swing, and I have Pat, my disposable beardy co-host. Just kidding. You're not disposable. And then I have BJ, who was at was with our other earlier episodes talking about, I don't even remember, it was so long ago.
Practice design. Scheduling and practice design.
That's right.
Yeah. Those were fun.
So, BJ, do you want to, since you brought it up that one time, do you want to kind of explain it, what the competitive cauldron is?
Sure. A guy by the name of Anson Dorrance, if you don't know this guy, you should look him up. He is the Al Skates of soccer. So obviously Skates won a ton of NCAA championships, 18 of them, 19 of them, something like that at UCLA. He was the gold star version of coaching, and he's still doing coaching podcasts and still involved with volleyball and a little bit with UCLA, it sounds like, still living in LA, still very active. Anyway, Anson Dorrance did the same thing in soccer. He got some soccer training in Europe and came to the United States. He's at another place that's had some athletic success at North Carolina. And every day he was going to work and hanging around where there's a guy, you know, where Dean Smith is. And Dean Smith had something like a cauldron going on in the basketball gym. I'm going off of memory, so this is, you know, it's loosely correct. But Anson decides that they're going to figure out a way to be competitive with their women's soccer team every single day in every single drill. They're going to figure out a way to keep score. And the cauldron idea is that we're going to compete in practice so that our motivation level goes up. Cauldron for Anson as the designer, and most people kind of agree this is the way to do it, is for competitive purposes in practice, to keep the practice rolling and keep the competition rolling. It's not to choose lineups. I think some people maybe make that mistake, but I think that's where it came from.
And I make that mistake. I use the cauldron to determine my starting outsides. Because I play a middle defense, I need the most all-around players, guys who can dig, pass, and hit. And so just that's the deal. That whatever the outside hitters are leading my cauldron, those are my guys. And honestly, I don't usually have more than – I'm lucky if I have two outside hitters that are game ready. But that's just – you know, that's the thing. When guys come to me talk about playing time, it's just cut and dry. The two guys who are leading the cauldron, those are my outsides. I need those guys to be six position guys. So, and I ideally my setter turns number three. I think they're having a winner at setter and being able to measure that, I think is pretty important.
Yeah, I think that was the mistake that I made, was that I tried to use it to determine lineups initially. I think this must have been like 5 or 6 years ago, and I think it was when I first heard about it. It was challenging because there were some kids in there that. It was more like a personality difference that I didn't really want to have them in. You know, like they just didn't mesh personality-wise.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, we last year at the 15-2s, we had a very competitive team. But, like, the head coach and I were kind of laughing because we didn't figure out what their war face looked like until, like, about this time, you know, like right before a couple of the last tournaments of the year down the home stretch. Because we're used to seeing, you know, the Black Mamba from Kobe, or, you know, Michael Jordan with his tongue out. Like, we're used to seeing those kind of athletes that just, like, exude that kind of, you know, competitive fire. And we just had that weird team that they worked really hard but had just a mute face. And as we went through more of the cauldron, like, okay, like, they're actually kicking the crap out of each other. They're working really hard just facially. You know, they don't celebrate exuberantly. They don't, you know, just a personality thing. And it took us most of the year to figure it out. So, I mean, I think also just the cauldron in ways helps you kind of learn what your team is, because you can see that they're making progress. You can see the gains, or the, you know, the kids kind of going up and down the ladder, so to speak. It just might not, it, the eye test can be, you can be fooled on the eye test, I think. So then there's also the fake hustle kids that look like they're trying really hard until you actually just watch them and you're like, oh, they're not working very hard at all.
Well, what you were saying is why I like using the cauldron to make my lineup. It takes away my confirmation bias. It's just the nature, human nature. There's just kids you're always going to have more confidence in. But when you can look at the numbers on paper, you can see that your confidence in them is not earned. And I just think with my guys, it's very easy for me just to have a non-emotional black and white. Here's on paper. Here's why you're not playing. Here's what you need to do to play. You know, how can I help you get better at whatever skill you think it is that you're lacking there?
Here's what I think about cauldron. And this is what I love about what Brian just said. If you're going to run any sort of a cauldron in your gym, you have to make sure that it fits your culture. You could run a cauldron that's you know, that's super competitive, and we're gonna, you know, everything is gonna be about competing and scoring points, and it could be totally wrong for your culture. So you have to, when you design a cauldron and you choose to use one, I think you need to make sure it fits your culture. And here in Brian's case, he's got it dialed in perfectly. Now we're going to use it because we need perfect's a bad word, but we're going to use this to, because we need something that's non-emotional and is objective and there's no bias. This is what we need. So I think he's using it exactly how it should be used.
I like what you said about being in the culture. And that's, you know, in my mission statement as a coach, that's what's in there, is that I can trick competitive young men into teaching themselves to play volleyball. And so I tailor the games, I tailor the drills to match what I want to get out of that. And as long as it's tuned that way, then I can take a kid who, as long as he's competitive and wants to win, he'll adapt and learn whatever skills he needs to win in that particular game we're playing. You know, it can be, you know, I'll play doubles where the first guy's got to make both contacts, you know, and that's getting that controllable dig and all that kind of thing. And I think that as long as I've got kids who care about what the score is, then I can tailor games that are going to teach them to get better. And the situation I'm in all the time as a coach in boys high school is I will usually get 5 to 6 senior boys who come out and play basketball or football in their senior year, think volleyball will be something they want to try. And then, you know, I'll have kind of a mix from there, but I'm always teaching very, very good athletes how to play volleyball in a very short time. And I just find that I can trick them into doing that by keeping them focused with the score.
Can we talk about first really quick, so those that don't know what it is, how do you score it? How do you keep track of it? What are the sort of games that you do to create those points, and how do you do it?
Number one tools is a whiteboard and your cell phone camera.
Yeah.
And you kind of need to decide what's important to you and how you want to weight it. I weight, because we play just so many doubles and triples, I weight those really high for the outsides and the opposites. When I'm scoring the setters, I really care more about setters being a winner in a 6-on-6 or a 4-on-4 type environment where they're doing the majority of the setting. And so once you get that set up, you just kind of want to look at how you want to weight everything. But I just keep all the scores on the whiteboard. At the end of practice, I take a picture, and then I go home and I sit down on my gold medal squared account and I enter in the numbers there.
Yeah, that's really similar to what we did. I didn't use gold medal squared, but I'm kind of an Excel guy, so I started building some stuff in Excel, and same thing with Brian. The basic idea is that you're keeping score on something that's important to you. So you can use all the same drills that you're using. We only really play, so we play 1v1, 2v2, 3v3, all the, you know, in lots of variations, but we scored the things that were important to us, which we can talk about later. But, you know, you keep track of score, and similar to what Kessel does, the kids keep track of their own scores. They go and write their own scores on the whiteboard. And then at the end of the day, just like Brian said, take a picture of the whiteboard, go home, punch stuff into Excel or whatever your system is, and then you have numbers. The important part is picking out the stuff that's important, and figuring out, you know, how to score that.
So, and for, I mean, coaching at Lights and leading the 15s, I would have on some days 5 teams on 3 courts where, let's face it, the coaching is tough to do, like, really fine-tune individual skill work just because there's a mass of kids. So we would do, you know, 6-on-6 between 2 teams, but everything was process-based that they would be scored on, and the 5th team would be on the 3rd court, and they'd have time, you know, 15 minutes of whatever they wanted to work on. But I mean, just stuff like off blocker, you know, getting to the right spot on defense, or, you know, making sure your pins are getting, you know, 4 feet behind the 10-foot line, or whatever the thing you wanted to work on was, that would be the only way your team could score points. So we really devalued scoring with the ball at times, because if you do the things we're asking you to do, you're going to score more anyway.
Do you guys usually do this primarily when you're playing? Or is it, you know, in your standard sort of regular drills, do you do it? When do you kind of find yourself doing these scoring for the competitive cauldron?
I don't know that I do a whole lot where there isn't a winner. And so I do it, I think every, you know, I'll warm up, you know, it starts with warm-ups. You know, I warm up with some variation of triples usually, or king of the court or speed doubles. And I want to get them in that competitive mindset right away.
Yeah, same. We the experiment that we did with it was keeping track every single drill, and it didn't matter if we were playing or running a drill sort of thing. We just wrote on the whiteboard, here's the important thing. We're going to be playing. Here's the thing that we're keeping score on. You can only score this way. But for us, the critical thing is we have a kind of a dual scoring system. So you're scoring points, cauldron points, by the thing that you want. But then there's also winning and losing the rally. So if you win the rally, you get to choose to serve or receive. So the rally is still important, but you're not getting cauldron points from just, you know, most of the time for us, you're not getting a point for winning the rally, but you do get to choose receive or serve. So if the cauldron point is on all three attackers getting, you know, all three front row attackers being ready to attack, then you want to receive because, you know, it's easier. You get to that point quicker. You can end the rally then, and then the other team cannot score their point. So that has been really effective for us. It's probably almost every drill is like that for us.
I really like that because I think that some players might look at, you know, even though it is competitive and getting those cauldron points, they still want to feel like they winning the rally means something. And so that's why it's great to have that little added twist to it where they, and then they have to think like, okay, so we're working on, you know, our hitters have to get all the way outside and do a specific spot to get a swing. Of course, you're going to want to have receive. So you have the first opportunity to do that. I love that. That is so smart.
You can't do three. Three is too many. They can't keep track of it. It's too confusing, but the dual scoring system, it's kind of the perfect amount of thinking. It feels like with, you know, kind of relatively high level high school age players. And I'm anxious to try it with my new team, with the D1 kids.
How about posting it? Do you guys make it public or is it something that you keep for yourselves? Because I think that definitely depends on age level and competitive level.
I think I've not posted it more than I have, but I think that's also just the luck of the draw of the teams that I've had and what that would have done to and for certain kids. Where if it's going to cripple seven of them and it's going to benefit three, I don't think that's worth me posting it then. But I think too, as they kind of go through it and the way we run it, I think you kind of know like, hey, I've been scoring a lot of points. This, you know, I've been putting up good numbers. I know I'm on the right track and hey, I've been losing a lot and I'm not putting numbers on the board. Okay. So, I think some of, you know, for some of them, that's all it takes is just having the realization of I haven't put a number on the board in a while.
A cool thing that happened for us when we ran Cauldron, it took me about two practices to realize that I didn't want any of it to be on winning rallies. I wanted it all to be process based. So we put every single Cauldron thing on, were they making a good choice? Were they making a read or were they doing what we asked? And what was cool was we saw the real learners were not the best players on the team. And they went right to the top of the cauldron because they were working so hard on figuring out that process thing. So if I would, I mean, even for me, and for my assistant, we'd have picked out different people that would have been at the top of the cauldron. And it was cool to see who got there. And by the end of the year, we agreed that the players at the top of the cauldron had made the biggest strides because they were doing all this process stuff. That was a big realization for me.
I like it. You kind of figure out who really is trying to understand the process and who is just there to win. I mean, winning is great. It's fun, but you have to have all six people on the court understanding the process of it and doing the process right in order to win. And even then you still don't win sometimes, but.
Well, and I think that gets back to the age old conversation of, if you want to just win, you know, take your 18 team play against a 12 team. You know, there's winning and there's winning the right way. And there's winning the way that's going to, you know, ultimately get you, you know, if your goal is to go to nationals and do well, there's a certain way you're going to have to play. And it's not just, I'm on serve receive and I get served and just throw the ball over on one back to zone one where the server's supposed to go. You know, like that works at 12s. And then by the time you graduate up to 13s, you're a terrible 13s player because that won't work anymore. You see it at the JV level. Certain programs value winning at JV the wrong way, and they have these great JV teams that win all these games, and they come to varsity, and they're just a dud. We saw that a lot in Buffalo. So it's just like, you know, winning is important, but winning the right way, like the style of winning, like what's going to translate to the next level? Like, what are you preparing them for? And I guess, like, Karch on the national team has to worry about a different set of problems because there's nothing really past that. But up until then, we are all preparing our athletes for the next level, I would hope.
Yeah, I think for the most part, I'm kind of the end of the road for most boys volleyball. Is that, you know, I've had, in 4 years, I think I've had two go on to play in college. And so for me, at the varsity level, I've done different things. Sometimes I just post the top six. And then so number seven doesn't know if he's number seven or if he's number 15. And so I don't really want to discourage number 13, 14, and 15. You know, I think those kids who constantly see their name at the bottom of the list might give up, you know, might not like volleyball or whatever, and that's not at all what I want to do. But other times I kind of go back and forth. But I think in life you need to be able to go off of your feedback. And that score on the board or the printout, that's your feedback, and you can kind of decide how you want to go from there. When I had coached 13-year-old girls, I didn't do it at all. You know, but with boys, and with the term is competitive cauldron, maybe among the four of us, we should come up with a developmental cauldron for those younger teams, those younger kids, where the growth is rewarded, improvements rewarded, you know, over, and so we're getting those kids that, you know, 12, 13s really aren't that good. You know, when my daughter was 12, she was the worst player on the court. Every time the ball went to her, it was a point for the other team. And it had been really easy for her to give up then. But, you know, she stuck with it and was quite a good player by the time she reached 18s.
He's dropping gold on us today. That's great stuff.
He's so smart. This is why we're friends.
And I think a lot of this, too, as we go deeper into this conversation, the first time you run it, you're going to think you're doing a great job. And then in 5 years, when you look back on it, you're like, oh, my gosh, I'm so embarrassed I ran it that way. Oh, this is all trial and error. It's not going to be perfect. No matter how hard you try to make it perfect, every group of kids will demand it to be a little bit differently by the way they play and their actions. And that's okay. Because what works with my 15s group does not work with my 17 twos. And they're 2 years apart. I mean, it doesn't, like, on paper, it should be pretty close, but just the specific needs of the five different 15s teams and the specific needs of those 10 girls on my 17 twos, it's worlds different. So just, you're going to be wrong and that's okay. Just be nimble and manipulate it and change it, and they'll appreciate it.
The cool thing about it is you, and this is great advice. I know this, the podcast that you're building here is for everyday coaches, right? You don't have to build a huge cauldron on every single thing that you do. You can,
I was about to say that.
You can choose one thing, and if I was a new, if I was a brand new coach in my first year, I would pick one of my drills out, and I would rank the passing, and we would just, that's all we would do is rank who the passers, you know, who passed well from this area or that area. And it would be during one drill and that would be it, because it can get really complex. I mean, there's a lot going on. If you've been coaching, you know, the longer you coach, you get a little bit more experience. You can build it into different drills and have different focus in each drill. But, and I, Yeah, you shouldn't let it overwhelm you is the biggest thing. You know, it can't become the only thing that's going on in practice.
Well, as a coach, you can use it for your own feedback. It doesn't necessarily have to be something that you can share with the players. You know, I think maybe even in 13s, 12s, you can kind of do that and, you know, with the kind of break the kids down into three levels. You're the advanced kids, the good athletes, the ones who played before. You have kind of your medium and then your small or your new players. And you can use that feedback to kind of look how you're, if you're bringing kids up from one level to the next, if you're third tier kids, if you're coaching in a way that they're improving, become second tier kids or something like that. I think there's some more feedback for that if you're not necessarily using this competitive. And I'm not joking. I think that we should come up with a developmental cauldron, a way to score that kind of thing. I think that would be useful for the coaches like us, you know, who aren't always coaching the 18 elite platinum national.
Elite, platinum, diamond, national. So what are some, like, let's just like come up with like a couple of examples of, you know, maybe things that you would use in your cauldron. So for me, and I know it depends on every team and the things that you're focusing on, but more like just basic things. Like, so for me, I remember I we were doing doubles, I think, or maybe we were doing skinny court triples because I wanted to work on two people going up and learning how to block together. They were little kids. So I did every time they actually went up to double block, whether they were successful or not, which they weren't because they're little. We scored on that. So we got, you know, they got a point every time they went up for a double block. So that's like a simple one, you know, and they can even count it themselves in their little group of three, you know, they count out loud, one, I got one because I did a double block. Another one I do is if the outside gets all the way out, I don't want necessarily like put a cone down because I don't want kids to run into stuff, but I have these rubber lines that I would just throw on the court. And so they have to make sure that they get all the way outside into the box in order to get a cauldron point.
So I was talking with our strength coach about sport coaching in general, and because he comes from a track and field background, so he doesn't know a ton about volleyball in terms of passing and setting a technique and how things are scored or anything like that, because that's not his world. But he knows about coaching, so it's interesting to get kind of that third party conversation where we can't get into specifics, we can only talk broad topics. And he was talking about how drills are made for decision making, not for skill development specifically, because if you make the right decisions, the right technique happens. And I was like, okay, that's very interesting. So then we started talking about, I started with that in mind, I created the 4 points of passing, in how you need to make four decisions on every serve receive about how you're going to position your body, how you're going to use your limbs and whatnot. So our competitive cauldron would just be every serve is worth 4 points. If you make the four decisions correctly, you get 4 points. If you make three of them, you get 3 points. And as the server, if you serve a ball and someone gets 2 out of 4, you get the other 2 points. Because if you're serving in a fashion that can get them to make poor decisions, you must be serving the ball well. And so it's kind of this tug of war concept, and our kids would eat it up. And we had, you know, on the whiteboard names and, you know, put your scores in after 10 serves, and they had a blast with that.
I'm working hard on player autonomy, a player having their, you know, having to realize what their decisions are. And so it's very similar to what Pat's doing. So I'll give you a pretty good example. We had players, we were working on block timing. For me, there's so much about timing that, you know, volleyball has a lot of timing issues. So we had the players in a blocking situation. They would block, and then they had to judge for themselves if they were early, on time, or late. And then there's a coach standing there. The player goes up and blocks. They come down, and they say late. And if the coach says yes, or you know, follows up with late, then the player gets the point, even though they were wrong.
I like that.
I was too late. Yeah, you're right. You were too late. So that there's your point because you made a good choice, you know, and you recognized what was going on. So we did a lot of experimentation with that, and that really helped with that.
I use the binary dog clicker type training where it's either a yes or a no. And yeah, the dog clickers guys don't hear enough in the crowded gym. So we're just yes, no. But, you know, it's part of that that rubric where, you know, you start off saying both the player and the coach agree that, no, you did not complete the skill. Then you get to the next step where one of the two of us agree that you did complete the skill. And then the last step is when you realize that we both agree you completed the skill. But I'll do that with passing. That's probably the closest block thing. I'll do just kind of a typical butterfly thing some days when we're just teaching passing. And we'll go with, you know, we'll just pick something. And we'll start with posture. So before we even throw a ball, they get a yes or a no. And then, you know, whatever happens after that, I don't care. And then we'll kind of move on to the next step. Elbows together on platform, yes or no. Or wrists together on platform, yes, no. And so it's never the result. It's the what we're doing. And I think the way that I always demonstrate this is I'll have somebody write their name on the board. And so we'll pretend that Sarah's writing her name on the board. And she'll write it. And we both agree that it says Sarah. But I'll tell her that her capital S is too small. Do it again. And so she'll go, and this time the S is the right size, but maybe the tail of the R goes too low. And I think a lot of times that's how kids end up being, where we coach them in a way that nothing is ever right. You know, we can, if we were really honest with them, we could pick apart something all the time. And so what we do is we'll, you know, as coaches being the year, we'll evaluate the keys that we used the previous year and if we want to use those going forward. And then we'll agree that on a certain day, with the major skills of serving, passing, hitting, and setting, that we will only address one of those keys. And so if the thing that day is calling the ball, then we don't care what we did, how the pass turned out, as long as it, you know, they made it clear that they were the ones going to take that ball. And just as coaching staff, we agree that that's the only thing that we're going to coach in that skill that day. And I think it's less frustrating for the kids. I think that they experience success more. They don't feel like they're being nitpicked as we could if we legitimately coached every single rep. But it's really weird, you know, if you're doing the yes, no with them, or not even do that, we do yes or silence. Silence is, you know, if they're not hearing that, it's, yeah. Definitely. And so that's actually a change we made for this year. We went from yes, no to yes or nothing. And the season got cut short before we could really evaluate the efficiency of that. But I liked it a lot more. I think that not having a sound just comes across much more than there being a sound, just not the sound you're looking for. It'd be like having a beep and a buzz. I don't know that you necessarily need the buzz. Just the lack of the beep is what they're going for.
That's cool.
Thanks.
That's efficient.
Stole it from somebody.
That's what I'm all about is efficiency. So I like that. Yeah.
It's hard. As a coach, you really got to swallow your ego to do it. You know, we think we know it all and we think that we can evaluate each and everything. But that's just not me. I'm just not very good at the minutiae of technique. So just having kind of big things that the kids can grasp, I think is important.
That's kind of like what Trevor was saying. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think.
Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, Trevor rules out.
Trevor wins. Yes. Hi, Trevor. I hope you're listening. It was kind of like what Trevor was saying about, I don't know if it was on our podcast or on his, but he said, you know, a lot of times when there's a mistake, like it could be the technique, but more than often it's the read. It's not this little tiny minutia of whether or not your arms were to them in your midline, or was it just a centimeter outside of it? And so I find that 100% to be true. Not to say that, and I know that's something that Brian and I have gotten a lot of criticism on, is that we don't focus on the technique. I think we do. We just give different weight to it, because I think Pat even said it, because Pat is so smart. Pat said the ball has a language, or you have to be able to speak the language of the ball or something like that. Yeah, I know. It was really smart and intelligent. And so it's basically about I don't know who said that. Maybe it was you. It was you. But you know, the ball has a language, and that you have to be able to speak it. And so, being able to read and know what the ball is doing is really important. The technique is great, but you can have all the technique in the world, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time every time because you don't know what's going on, that's not going to really do you any good. But Trevor was so right about, you know, he's worked with so many athletes, you know, big athletes, and he was talking about major league hitters, and it's like, is your elbow too high or too low? Well, it's probably your read on the pitch.
BJ, didn't you write the thing this week about something about you guide them and it's up to them to steer? Didn't you have something like that this week you posted?
Yeah, I don't know if it was me, but I agree with that for sure. I mean, it's not more and more. It's obvious to me that the player is in charge of what they're doing. I mean, it's the player's career. It's their volleyball career. You're there as a consultant, basically. You know, I think there's too many coaches that are just, you're going to do it this way because this is my gym and this is the way we do things and my program, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's an element of that maybe, but man, the player comes in and they want to learn something, or they want to compete, or they want to be around a bunch of friends or something. They have, you know, they have their wants and needs and desires and all that kind of stuff. So I very much agree with that. I think the player has to steer, and you know, as coach, we can't be with the player for the whole 2 hours. We get 12 kids out there. There's 2 hours. Each kid gets 10 minutes, you know, of your specific time. So the kid's got another 110 minutes where they gotta, you know, they gotta be empowered to be coaching themselves.
I can't remember if it was Kobe or if it was Steve Nash. We talked about it, but they were talking about how their daughters played volleyball and how it seemed like their daughter always had to have a coach working with them, whereas in basketball they just go to the park and just shoot threes till their arms fell off, and that was how they got to where they got to. And I don't know, as a whole in volleyball, I think we've over, which is a weird thing for me to say in a podcast of four coaches, that's four coaches. I think volleyball coaching as a whole is too self-important. Like, we feel like we are, as a whole, probably more important than we really are for the kids' development. And I think not enough kids grab a couple friends and go to the beach and whack a ball around. I know I did that, but I think I was more in the minority than most. I've played, you know, through my playing career, I played more by myself than under the supervision of a coach. And I think it was the hours I spent playing got me to where I needed to be more than any coach ever did. But I feel like the coach was there to hone me rather than create me. I feel like I created myself.
Maybe less is the new more. less coaching.
Boom. Well, thank you again for you guys all joining this and having a wonderful discussion on a variety of random topics, which I love. This is exactly what I want to have happen, is coming up with new things, just rambling on about volleyball nerd stuff. So I love it.
Great stuff. Yeah, it was nice.
Stay tuned for weeks in the future.
It was nice virtually meeting you guys finally.
Yeah.
Putting a moving face with just the avatar that I see on Facebook.
Well, thanks again, guys.
All right. Nice seeing you.
Nice seeing you all.
Bye.